Oh, hello. Sorry, I was just doing a spot of reading. My name is Dan Barrett, joined by Simon Foster. Simon, this is the book Shortcomings, which is a graphic novel by Adrian Tamine.
Yeah.
I believe that as we speak right now on Friday night, the Australian premiere of the movie Shortcomings, a film that I could not be more desperate to go and see right now, is currently playing as part of the Sydney Film Festival. And Simon Foster just throws cautions to the wind tonight and is like, yeah, I've got tickets to that, but I'm just going to record a little podcast. And I could not be jealous right now.
More jealous of me not being at it, as that I've, you know, as you say, I've tapped out of my Sydney Film Festival duties and instead wanted to be here with your pasty face. But no, here we are, and let's see how it goes.
Remind me to tell you sometime about the attempts that I made to option some of the works of Adrian Tamine, the graphic
novels. No way.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, we'll talk about that sometime off the microphone. People don't need to know about that on the microphone.
Awesome.
Yeah. Folks, this is Screen Watching. That was our pre-production meeting. And I guess maybe dive straight into the podcast. This is the podcast where we talk about things that we've watched on screens, big screens, small screens, really tiny screens, all of it. So look, let's play the opening titles. We'll come back on the other side. We'll tell you what we're going to talk about on the podcast and we'll get this thing on the show. What do you think?
I'm excited because I've got a new microphone and I want to see how badly I sound on it. So let's go.
Okay, excellent. Folks, this is Screen Watching.
This is not like TV only better.
Television! Teacher! Mother!
Secret lover.
What, that's it? That's your movie?
Well, I said that I had an idea for a movie.
Hey dudes, this is Screen Watching. We're here. We've got reviews of some movies and TV shows. Simon Foster, I'm not going to ask how you are. Instead, I'm just going to dive in and tell you what I'm going to be talking about on the podcast this week. I'm going to do a movie this week, a big feature film. And spoiler alert, I'm going to talk about TV shows as part of that review. But anyway, it's a big feature film called The Flash. Also, I've got a little TV show that I'm going to be doing a bit of a review for as well. It is an Australian series. And look, some people may say, why are you wasting your time reviewing this TV program? Like, aren't there bigger things starring Tom Holland you could be discussing? And I would say, no, this is a TV show that's based on one of Australia's biggest websites. It's definitely Australia's biggest satirical website. It's a show called The Batuta, Batuta Advocate Presents. And I'm going to discuss what's going on with that program because I found something about it to be particularly interesting. Simon Foster, what are you talking about this week?
Well, I'm talking about two new releases in the cinemas this week, my friend. Elemental is the new big Disney Pixar film, which has some fairly mixed reviews going into it, but I'm looking forward to having a chat about it. And yeah, I'm talking
on,
about...
Based on the audience tracking, because obviously it's opening weekend right now in the US and here, obviously.
Yeah.
Based on the tracking, if you discuss it and you reference one or two other critics that saw it, that may be 90% of all the people that will see that movie on a big screen.
Yeah, it's tracking well below the average Disney Pixar release, that's for sure, which kind of surprises me, but I'll see. And I'm also talking about my favorite gal, Julia Louis-Dreyfus. She's in a new film called You Hurt My Feelings with a guy called Tobias Menzies, who everyone seems to know but me. Every time I mention his name, they go, oh, I love Tobias, but I don't think I'd ever seen him before in anything. But he's with Julia Dreyfus in the new Nicole Holofcener film, and I'll be talking about that.
Okay, your favorite gal, Julia Louis-Dreyfus. How does the lady who lives in your house with you, how does she feel about that?
The maid's fine with it. She only comes in twice. Oh, you mean my wife? She shares a similar affection for Julia Louis. So it's not a weird, wacky thing that I have for Julia Louis-Dreyfus, as beautiful and wonderful as she is in that regard. I just think she's an extremely talented lady. And I'm going to be talking more about that as part of my review.
Okay, well, this sounds like an exciting podcast. I think that, as is mandated by the UN, there's only one thing you can do once you've done the intro to the podcast and the preface, the opening remarks, that is that you go ahead, you play a jingle, and then a sting, some may refer to it in a biz as, but in the UN they call it a jingle. And then after that you come back and you forward the momentum with the reviews. So we'll do that? Yes? Okay, cool. We have quorum. Okay, on we go.
It stinks.
Simon, let's dive right into The Flash.
Wayne.
I love you.
Thank you.
Passing you into Mr. Wayne.
No, please don't.
I need you here now, Barry.
Oh, Simon, sorry, you just caught me reading Hero Flash comic. Let me just pop this down and we'll get on to the review. So look, this movie, The Flash, 2023's The Flash, I was crazy excited about seeing this movie. And this is actually the culmination of a little fantasy I've been harboring for, doing the maths, carrying the three, about 31 years.
Oh, so, no. Does it involve red tights and a funny red helmet?
I mean, it will. So hold tight. Things are getting pretty wild. Okay, so my entry point to The Flash was back in 1990. So actually, no, sorry, 33 years now. Back in 1990, there was a TV series starring John Wesley Shipp. People would know him later in his career as being in Dawson's Creek and then parodied a couple of years later in that TV show that I can't think of the name of. That was about the behind the scenes of a teenage soap, and the lead actor in the series was having an affair with the man playing his father on the show. Some people have suggested it was John Wesley Shipp, but anyway, we'll move past that. We'll just get back to the fact I was watching the show with him in tights. The Flash lasted one season. It was very heavily inspired by the success of the Batman movie that was in cinemas just the year prior. And so this opens with a Danny Elfman theme song. It's dark and gritty like the Batman Tim Burton movie. It feels very Burton-esque in that it is dark and gritty, but it's got like bright lights and a lot of colors and a man running around in a costume. It was a TV show I really enjoyed quite a fair bit as a youngster. I've watched it later on. It doesn't quite hold up entirely, but like it's not too bad either. Like, you know, it's fine for what it is. It's a 1990 action adventure show.
So it played on TV out here? Because I have no recollection of it. I remember being a VHS release. I think they released the pilot episode on one of the things, but I never remember it playing on telly here.
Yeah, I feel it's a two-hour pilot episode from memory. I'm pretty sure that's right. But yeah, so it definitely played here. It was one of these things that played at like, you know, 11 o'clock on a Friday night, some nights, and then like 2 weeks later it'd appear at like 3 a.m. But, you know, essentially I caught most of it. So I didn't see all the episodes, but I certainly caught up later in life. So I really liked that show, and it was kind of my entry point into The Flash, a character that I wasn't that familiar with previously. But I started reading some of the comics. I became very smitten with it very, very quickly. So The Flash was actually, and probably still is, like next to Superman, like my favorite sort of comic book character. But this time, I've been thinking about the fact that I would love to see The Flash in a big screen movie, because you could give the character the level of special effects to it that you kind of need to really make this character pop. Okay. And so all of my life, since I was 10, I've been waiting to see The Flash on the big screen, see those special effects really just sort of pop. And of course, we had the Flash TV show, so it wasn't like I couldn't imagine what the Flash might look like on screen. And then in the last couple of years, it's literally just finished up in the last few weeks, we had a new Flash TV series, which has far better special effects than they had back in 1990, obviously.
And, of course.
It was a big, ambitious effort to try to bring a comic book sensibility to the Flash TV series, and they kind of got away with it, and that show was fine. I didn't really watch a lot of it. There was other issues with that show that stopped me from really watching it, but it was perfectly fine, and like I got to see the Flash run. But even so, it was still a TV-ish budget, and I thought, you can see something amazing in this. So lo and behold, I sat down on Tuesday night to watch the Flash movie, the culmination of so much that I've been anticipating. I got to see that first scene where he starts really sort of peeling out, and two things happen. One, when you first start seeing the Flash run, he goes on a run like from one city to another, and then the camera pans out really, really far, and you don't really see him run exactly. You kind of sort of see him run, like you get the idea that he's running fast, but you don't really see him properly peeling out. And then when you get to see him really sort of use the speed force, when he gets in there in a big sort of opening sequences, Batman's racing around town doing something else while the Flash has got to save some babies falling out of the building, quite literally.
Great opening.
It's like he gets to run, and then we get to watch a man in incredibly slow motion, not really doing much that we haven't seen people do on screen a whole bunch over the last 10 years. And I got to say, Simon, from that perspective, I was crazy disappointed, because I really thought the big screen could offer a special effect completely unlike anything I'd seen so far. And then it does fucking nothing.
So before you move on, to other opinions, let me just react to that. I too, just about from the special effects from the running point of view, I too was a bit disappointed in that. Oh, they're just going to like slow down his legs and have like a slow motion kind of $6 million man style flash just running like that.
The idea, sorry, just to convey what's actually taking place on screen. The idea isn't that, you know, we're getting a Zack Snyder style things that are just in slow-mo for no apparent reason, but really we're supposed to be able to see him sort of moving and thinking between the ticks of a second.
Yeah.
That's the
idea. So the only issue I had is, How would the special effects team do it in a way that doesn't otherwise look kind of ridiculous, like the Superman wobbly legs when Clark Kent was a boy running next to the train in the 1977 movie or 1978 movie? I was trying to think how else they might have done it over the two and a half hour length movie. But do go on. That was something that perplexed me at the time and was the first challenge that I don't know if this production fully overcame.
Yeah, so, I mean, the problem that I have with that sort of Running Man special effect is that we only ever see it from his perspective and not really from the external world, which I just found really frustrating. But... and also the wobbly leg thing. I mean, bear in mind that you were talking about a movie from 1978. I kind of think special effects have gotten a little bit better than that since.
Oh, that's debatable, but we'll see.
I think
having seen some of the special effects in this movie, I would argue that, but let's see.
You know, I've actually heard some criticisms of the special effects in this, and I didn't think it was that bad. I mean, I've seen far worse on big screen from, Ant-Man comes to mind really quite prominently, but yeah. I don't know.
So where do you go from here, Mr. Flash?
But yeah, so
what's up next for you, story wise? Does this work?
Okay, so story wise, and this is kind of why I wanted to open talking about my history with the character a little bit, in that one of the things with the Flash is that the Flash is a bit of a unique superhero in that he's one of the first superheroes that was kind of a comic book publication since, I mean, the 40s when the character was first introduced. But when he's introduced initially, he's this guy named Jay Garrick. Okay. In the 60s, in about 1962, I think, we have the dawn of what they call the Silver Age of comics, and it begins with The Flash. And what's particularly unique there is that it's not Jay Garrick anymore. They replace him entirely with this guy named Barry Allen, who's a very boring scientist, and that's kind of his thing, just being a boring scientist. Okay, and in that first issue you see with him, which is in Showcase issue 4, there we go, there's my nerd cred.
Okay,
you do see for a moment reading like a Flash comic with Jay Garrick in it, so it's a bit of a nod to the Flashes that had come by. Okay, but ostensibly this was the beginning of a new age of comics, and it was kind of about the beginning of fusing like science, which was becoming like a real sort of pop cultural thing in the 60s, in with the comics. So it's like an entirely new approach to it. So it's an entirely different character with an entirely different style of being the Flash. The costumes are wildly different. Over a couple of years, because it's superheroes, he gets a sidekick, which is this guy named Wally West. And then in the mid-80s, the Flash books, I'm mentioning this all for a reason, Simon. But in mid-80s, like the Flash books just aren't selling at all. So they make a really bold decision to kill off the Flash in this big comic book event called Crisis of Multiple Earths. Okay. They kill off the Flash and then Wally West takes over. So what we've got here is a character that is multi-generational, and it's kind of about like identities, like there's different identities sort of being depicted here as part of the Flash. My Flash is the third one, Wally West. Like he's the guy that I always think of as being the Flash. But older people than me, like people of your vintage, Simon, you're probably a Barry Allen guy if you're a comic book guy. I'm just saying.
Like, we're going to get to how unfamiliar I am with anything to do with the Flash at some point. But yes, I get your point.
Yeah. So ultimately, you've got this thing where there's these multiple sort of identities of the Flash. And so as they kill off the Flash, it's part of this event called Crisis of Multiple Earth, because they realized in the mid-1980s that having like 20, 30 years of comics where they're all traveling to multiverses with all these sort of bizarre like versions of the characters all sort of appearing in comic books was just kind of a bit silly and dumb and stupid and really hard to track. So they decided to condense their entire publishing. So it was just like one single universe, got rid of multiverses entirely. Okay. And the person who is there at the center of restarting the universe is Barry Allen. And he sacrifices himself so that the universe can live. So there's this great irony with watching this movie that this franchise, which is based on all these different characters, okay, suddenly you see a version of Barry Allen on this, who in no way represents any of the other Flash characters we've ever seen in a comic book or animated series. It's like this entirely new thing. So I'm like, well, why are you even calling him Barry Allen? Why is he not just, you know, Steve Jones? I don't really understand that.
Yeah.
Because this character is in no way at all. And like, people have just been watching a Flash TV show, which, I mean, even then, that's a slight sort of, you know, hipper version of a Barry Allen, but he's still a bit of a boring scientist guy. Like, at least you've got that. You don't have that in that movie. So it's weird from an identity standpoint, but it's also weird that the first Flash movie out is really introducing the idea of multiverses in a big way, because this character iconically is the one that shut that shit down.
All right, let me. I just want to ask one question. So, the Flash that we're seeing on screen this week, the Ezra Miller version of the Flash, the sort of the young, goofy, not quite sure how to handle his powers, superhero kind of thing. So this is that entirely a creation of the Snyder era of DC? Yeah, it's just been in the movies.
100%.
Okay, all right. Yeah. That makes sense to me. Well, that's good, because I don't come to the Flash. To me, the Flash, it's sort of like DC's Ant-Man to me. I didn't know anything about Ant-Man until Paul Rudd took the role. And the Flash to me is, well, he just comes across as one of these second-tier superheroes that, you know, they'll churn out a movie to keep the rights or whatever, that don't really have any long-term impact. And so the Flash for me was kind of like an Ant-Man film. But go on.
Yeah. I mean, I will say the Flash is a vital character with a very rich publishing history that, you know, he's certainly second tier to like a Superman and a Batman. But as far as DC is concerned, like, he's one of the real top characters. Like, he's suddenly right up there. Whereas Ant-Man with Marvel is definitely like that third, fourth, fifth tier sort of a character that's been elevated because of the movies. Mm-hmm. Okay, so putting all that aside, there was just definitely an irony about sort of seeing this character sort of be an entirely new character, considering that there'd been so many other Flashes, and that was all a bit weird. And then the multiverse aspect. Stripping all of that down, if I was sitting down, much like you did, for the first time, being completely unfamiliar, I'd say pretty entertaining movie, okay? For the most part, like, I think that most of the jokes kind of land. I find the approach to character maybe slightly annoying. There's two versions of the Barry Allen character, which I kind of liked that it wasn't just like a multiverse version of Barry Allen. Instead, they kind of actually play with two versions of the same guy from like 10 years apart. So they are a little bit, 10 years, maybe 7 or 8 years, something like that. Mm-hmm. But that's certainly not the same age, and they're in like different sort of life stages. So that was kind of fun, and it was good seeing Ezra Miller playing those two sort of distinct characters. I thought the special effects work. It didn't feel like Liberace, you know, Batman TV show, in the way they have, you know, two Liberaces on screen at the same time. Like, it kind of felt like they were acting opposite like another actual live actor in a space. So that was cool. I thought that was a really good sort of performance, and the jokes they milked from that aren't really too bad. Like, you know, most of those gags all work. I think the plot works out pretty well. I guess maybe one of the things that you probably need to know going into this is that it comes out, 2 weeks after Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse came out.
Yes, we're going to get to that in a minute, just how familiar it is.
That's exactly it. Like, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse plays so much with the multiverse, and it's just this idea of canon, these moments in time that can't be changed, which is kind of exactly what the Flash movie the next week is playing with, the exact same idea of. And I felt really bad for all involved in this movie here, because ultimately, the Flash.
Because 2 weeks ago, it was done a whole lot better.
Well, it was done better in that. And there was something else that was done better. I'm going to get to that in just 1 second. But I felt bad because I kind of feel the Flash character really is the focal point for multiverses. And like, if you're going to play around in the multiverse, the Flash is the perfect character for that. Okay. But they got beaten out by like a week and a half in terms of big screen audiences. So I felt a bit bad for that. But what that Spider-Man movie does so much better than this one does, and the big selling point for this, is that they're bringing the Michael Keaton Batman into this. At the same time, you also get to see the Ben Affleck Batman. You get to see Wonder Woman. You get to see variations on the Supergirl character, who's a multiverse version of a world where Superman didn't quite make its worth. There's just all these sort of alternate reality possibilities that are at play in this movie. And you look at this, and there's definitely a sequence where they take you to see what is effectively not just the characters that you're kind of seeing on screen there, where Batman's got a fair bit of screen time and whatnot, but you kind of see like the actual multiverse of different types of cinematic incarnations of these characters. So you get to see, and this had already been spoiled, so I feel okay just mentioning on a podcast here. You get to see the Nicolas Cage Superman from the production that never was. You get to see Christopher Reeve on screen for a moment. You get to see...
George Reeves.
I wasn't going to mention George Reeves just yet. But you get to see Helen Slater, who played Supergirl. Like, you get to see a few moments of these characters appearing on screen, but you do get a very brief glimpse of a Adam West Batman in there. And you get a very brief glimpse of George Reeve as Superman from the 50s Adventures of Superman
way, TV way show. Back. Yep.
Where the Spider-Man did a really great job is that while it's playing around with the multiverses, it actually gave like a whole bunch of Spider-Men from different cross-media a huge opportunity to shine on screen. A whole bunch of them, you got the sense that they were like different characters. You got a bit of a vibe as to what their personality was. And like they really play around with that. In this Flash movie, you sort of see some visual glimpses of some of these people, but they're not really interactive characters, and they're all mostly just movie characters. Yes, you've got Adam West. Yes, you've got George Reeves, but you don't have Grant Gustin, who played the Flash in 9 or 10 seasons, I can't remember, of a TV series which just wound up. Why isn't he featuring in a Flash movie about a multiverse where you've got multiple versions of the Flash? Why is that not happening? Why is John Wesley Shipp not in it? It's just kind of bizarre. And like the movie is perfectly entertaining. I had a good time with it, but I just got left at the end just trying to work out why they made some of these choices, because it just kind of felt like they're betraying what the possibilities were with this movie.
All of that is fascinating from the perspective of someone for whom the Flash sort of iconography and lore is really important. To someone like me who comes at it as a movie and is able to is only able to review it as a movie, I would say it finds a couple of nice humanistic beats along the way, especially in scenes in which he has to interact with himself. Barry Allen has to interact with themselves. And
I find it funny,
but then,
sorry, Simon, I find it funny that there's a love romance sort of thing that's a bit shoehorned into the movie. But when you see him appearing opposite themselves in there, it reminds me of that Seinfeld bit where Seinfeld is declaring out loud, "I found what I've always been looking for romantically in my life. Me."
And it's me. Like,
the sexual tension that Ezra Miller has with himself, I think, is
palpable.
Yeah. But with
it's very true.
Gosh, what's her name? Female lead in
Sasha Kelly.
No. Kirstie Clemens, who plays Iris West, the love interest.
All right, yes. Yeah.
There's just like no tension there whatsoever. Sorry,
whatsoever at all. But once those gentle sort of humanistic moments and like gentle comedy beats are sort of played out, this just becomes rote superhero stuff for me, just big, loud, special effects-y type of stuff, which runs an unforgivable 144 minutes. It would have been a much tighter, more skillfully made and far more enjoyable 95 or 96 minute movie. 144 was just too long. I got a bit of a buzz out of seeing all those Supermans lined up, but as you point out, it's just to show them. They don't have any other sort of significant function in this film. And the crowd that I saw it with when...
In this section of the podcast, co-host Diamond Foster suddenly got wild with some spoilers and said out loud the absolute number one big spoiler of the movie that has been very much under wraps. First rule of Fight Club is not to mention that scene.
So when they showed the Supermans and the Batmans and the crowd around me cheered a bit, I realized it served more just the fan service functionality and not any real clever sort of storytelling nod. And all I could think was, okay, this is kind of a riff on Spider-Man. There's a dead parent. There's having to deal with that as a young man growing up. There's multiverses, which Spider-Verse did much better a couple of weeks ago. And all in all, this is a very mediocre film ultimately. And you're right, I quite enjoyed watching it, but within 3 or 4 hours afterwards coming home, I'd grown a little bit icky with it. So, yeah, I thought this was a bit of a misfire.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's a misfire. I think that it's a perfectly enjoyable film. Yes, I think it's a little bit long. I wouldn't be chopping 45 minutes out of it the way that you were just suggesting, but I think you could easily cut out 20 minutes and for it to be just a little bit more of a smooth ride. Something I will say about it, though, is that there's a time travel element involved in this. And the actual physical, like the visual depiction of time travel, they actually kind of, it's more visually interesting than I think I've seen in most other movies. Like, they do something just a bit different with it. And, you know, I think certainly credit's due for approaching something which was seen on screen a whole bunch of times in, you know, a fairly sort of clever, interestingly visual way.
Okay, so it's called The Flash. It's in cinemas everywhere. You've probably heard about it by now. It's certainly getting a massive marketing push. We had some snarky words to say about Elemental at the start of the top of the podcast. I don't think The Flash is tracking a whole lot better. Yes, it's going to open bigger probably in the US, but sort of tapping in at about 70% on Rotten Tomato the last time I looked, it's not exactly brimming with buzz itself, it's got to be fair to say.
Box office wise, it's actually not doing too bad. So I was reading some reports about that. So it's, as we're talking about this, like, it's Friday night and there still hasn't been more than just preview showings in the US, but it's on track for, you know, essentially being the equal of things like Venom, which was an overperformer at the cinema. Like, they're probably going to struggle because this is a huge budget movie compared to some of the other superhero films. And there's been extensive reshoots for all sorts of reasons going on with it. So, like, it's such a huge budget, but it's probably on, like, the sort of upper tier of box office. So it's actually doing all right financially.
Next one, for me, in cinemas as we speak, is the new Disney Pixar film. It's called Elemental.
Meet the residents of Element City. Air usually has their head in the clouds.
Oh, my new jacket!
Earth can be a little seedy.
Nothing weird going on here.
Just a little pruning.
More than just preview showings in the US, but it's on track for, you know, essentially being the equal of things like Venom, which was an overperformer at the cinema. Like, they're probably going to struggle because this is a huge budget movie compared to some of the other superhero films. And there's been extensive reshoots for all sorts of reasons going on with it. So, like, it's such a huge budget, but it's probably on, like, the sort of upper tier of box office. So it's actually doing all right financially.
Next one, for me, in cinemas as we speak, is the new Disney Pixar film. It's called Elemental. Drop it in. Elemental is the story of a... I'm going to start that again, sorry. I took a big breath in. In the world of Elemental, we find two people in love, and by people I mean elements of Earth, be they fire, water, air, or land. In this case, it's fire and water. Ember is a very feisty teenage girl who is made up entirely of fire. She lives with her fire parents in the fire neighborhood of Elemental City. Wade is a young man working as an inspector for the Elemental local government, and he discovers that Ember's family cafe, where they serve fire treats, has broken all sorts of codes. He plans to shut the place down. She plans to stop him. And from that point on, the two elements, which don't usually meet up, fire and water, develop in a very romantic comedy kind of way towards a very sweet love story. So that's your basic plot summary for a cartoon movie. They do a whole lot of world building, a whole lot of creation of stunning cityscapes and waterways and fiery sort of fountains. They also create some very vivid characters in this. It's directed by a guy called Peter Sohn, who was responsible for Pixar's first real box office underperformer in The Good Dinosaur about 10 years ago. He's been given a second chance with Elemental. He's got a great eye, and he's got a lovely way with words too. He's the script for this paints a really sweet picture of these two and all the sundry characters around them. What it is really about, and this will be lost on the real littlies who get along to this, but it won't be lost on the parents, especially in this, the political climate in which we live. It's a story about immigrants. The fire people come from a different land. They've had to leave that land because of terrible upheavals in their society, and they land in what is ostensibly a cartoon version of New York City, but they're shunted to their own neighborhood, far away from the water and the land and the air people, because they just don't mix with fire. And it's about a family traditions, dealing with what you bring with you from the old world and trying to put yourself into the new world. It's also about how this new world is very hard for those that immigrate to the new world integrate. And in that regard, it works pretty well as a kind of a social commentary story, the kind of underpinnings and subtext that you don't often see, not to this degree anyway, in the Disney Pixar animated world. So I guess I responded to that in giving it a fairly positive review. It also looks stunning. I did read somewhere that they're using AI to do some of the background on it, and it's one of the first Hollywood films to sort of openly admit saying, yeah, we got inspiration from using AI to create our backdrop. So that's going to cause a bit of discussion in the weeks ahead.
You know,
I don't think it will.
Nobody's talking about this movie at all.
I don't think that's true. I think they're certainly giving it a push, and I think there's an element there that, pardon the pun, that will respond to this movie in a certain way. No, it's not going to be a Moana or a Tangled or anything like that for the Disney Pixar team. This will be one of their mid-range ones, but I think it's one of their more ambitious ones and one of their more grown-up ones. So, I quite liked Elemental. I was surprised by how much I was engaged by it.
Yeah, I don't know. I kind of feel like most people where Pixar stuff these days, I'm just going to wait and watch it on Disney Plus, where it'll be there in like 5 weeks' time.
Yeah, and it's funny, there was a whole lot of animated trailers before this film, and there was a couple of very conventional sort of Disney princess type movies trailered, one called Wish. What was the other one called? I can't remember now. But
there was a short that played before it, which was a sequel to the movie Up.
Oh, yeah.
How was that?
A sequel of sorts. It's called Carl's Date, which is an unusual title, having said that out loud. And it's about the elderly man, still voiced by the late Ed Asner. So they must have got the voice work in the can before he passed away. And it's basically Carl being asked on a date by an elderly woman and what he goes through to prepare for that. He's a very nervous sort of first date since his lovely Ellie passed away. So, and of course, Doug gets all the laughs as the talking dog, or the dog with the talking collar. So, it was good. It didn't have quite the sort of rich animation that Up had, but it was still a sweet, fun story.
Yeah. Okay. Well, definitely worth seeing for that, I guess, and then maybe leave after that.
Don't be mean. Elemental's a really interesting film. I was surprised because I was like you. I'd heard that it'll get out there. It'll be on Disney Plus in a month's time, which will probably still be the case. But it was a smarter, more interesting film than I thought it was going to be. And plus, it had some great voice acting work from the two leads as well. Two young actors I hadn't heard of. So called Elemental in wide release. Are there school holidays coming up? Get your family along to that. It's probably a bit too loud for your little at this stage, but it'll come around in years to come.
Yeah. Let's move on and talk about the TV event of the decade. It's the Batuta Advocate Presents.
Hello, I'm Clancy Overall.
And my name is Errol Parker.
We're editors of the Batuta Advocate, and we'd like to welcome you to the set of our new TV show, The Batuta Presents. This is behind the scenes, I believe that's the terminology, BTS.
Yep, the Americans are here.
Yep, they're asking us questions. Softballs, I hope.
Yep.
So this one had me a little bit sort of curious, a bit interesting. So The Batuta Advocate, if people aren't aware of it, it's a satirical website, and like I think most people are aware of it because you see it shared around a whole lot, even if you don't actively visit the website yourself, which is certainly the experience I have with it. It's a left-leaning, progressive, satirical comedy website. So think about The Onion, think about what The Chase has sort of started out being. The Shovel is like another Australian satirical site. It's very much of that sort of mold. The gimmick with the Batuta is the Batuta Advocate is that it's a fake newspaper supposedly from regional Australia. And that's kind of the joke with it, which is that it purports to be a regional newspaper, which Australia's regional areas tend to be a bit more right-wing and a bit more conservative in a lot of ways, but it is this left-wing politics sort of coming through on it. So that's kind of the joke of that newspaper. So
it can be very sharp. I should just point out my favourite Batuta, as a football fan, my favourite Batuta Advocate headline was 40-year-old rugby league player can't decide between retiring and 3-year contract with the West Tigers.
Yeah, so that's funny.
Which still cracks me up. It was very funny.
And see, this is the thing. So, like, the website is genuinely really funny. And because it's been such a successful website, like, it does monster traffic as far as, like, the Australian sort of online scene's concerned. People were chasing them to do a TV program, which, I mean, these days, anyone who's had success with the web being chased by TV, like, you're really just wasting your time. You can get far better audiences through your web engagement than you can through your TV. But I think people are still a bit nostalgic for TV. And so when TV comes calling, I guess the guys from the Batuta Advocate were definitely keen to give that a bit of a go. So I was curious to know what a Batuta Advocate TV program would look like, because it's the guys that run the thing and, like, quite... They've been a very active presence in terms of video representations of the fictional characters that published the newspaper. So you kind of know what these guys look like because we have seen them, like, on TV ads, and they've suddenly spruced themselves in other ways. You hadn't seen them before, Simon?
I'd never seen them. In fact, I was going to ask you if the two talking heads they had on the trailer, which is all I've seen of this, I watched the trailer this afternoon on YouTube, if that's them, if that's the actual guys that run the comic site.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
And, like, they appear in ads and, you know, they are generally sort of known around the place. It may even just be, like, YouTube videos. I've got no idea how I really know them. I just kind of know that they look like this. So where I was curious to know what they would be bringing to the screen. And what I saw was just really disappointing. And I don't really understand why this exists in the form that it does and why there were no sort of questions asked at some point. So... the general sort of approach that they take to it is exactly the same as a whole bunch of those podcasts you find that take moments from history and effectively read out Wikipedia articles and then try to, you know, liven it up a little bit. So sometimes those take the form of real history podcasts or true crime podcasts, that kind of thing, where they're kind of just reading out established, like, easy to find research. And then passing it off as, like, their own sort of podcast, as though they've really got a lot more to add to it. And generally these things don't. So this is kind of Wikipedia, the podcast, the show. Excuse me, Simon. The first episode looks at Hillsong. And the thing is, like, I'm reasonably familiar with the story of Hillsong, and this didn't really present that different. So... they've got a few talking heads that are not the guys from the Batuta Advocate, but they're just, like, you know, general people. There's the guy that created the music initially for the Hillsong churches. There's some other guy. I can't remember who he was. There's a woman who's a journalist. I didn't really know her either. But, like, they, outside of this one moment where this guy tells this anecdote about how he started speaking in tongues, quote unquote, and really, he was just saying yabba dabba do in different sort of forms. And then other people around him just started copying him saying yabba dabba do as though, like, they were speaking in tongues as well. And so he realized how susceptible people were around it. And it was a moderately amusing anecdote, but, like, that's the only actual anecdote that's really told. The
rest sounds really troubling to me.
Well, that's it. So the rest is just talking heads just saying that stuff happened. And then it's sort of intercut with little animated pieces, which aren't really entirely that funny. But, like, they kind of present, like, a vibe of what this is all about.
And if this could really undo all the popularity that... Isn't there a great risk that by taking the bucks for something like this and not being able to deliver the content, that it could really unravel their online popularity?
Well, it's fine because nobody subscribes to Paramount Plus and watches it. So it's not going to be an issue for them. I mean,
I'm glad we're reviewing it. That's great.
Well, no, but, like, the reason I'm reviewing it is because it's the Batuta Advocate. Like, this is kind of the thing. And what I think I want to take away, so they've got these talking heads that don't really say much, but then you've also got the main guys from Batuta, and then there's a third guy that they cut to who, much like the guys from the Batuta Advocate in their costuming, they are people in sort of, you know, okay-ish sort of beaten down suits with, you know, like, cowboy hats. Like, they look like Australian regional... you know, guys in that sort of very stereotypes. Thing. Yeah, with, like, ties that are kind of a bit undone and, you know, just kind of a little disheveled, but at the same time kind of present nicely. You've got the two main guys, but then they cut to a third guy who's the Batuta Advocate's religion expert, okay? And he's just another guy who looks like them. That ostensibly is a funny joke, but he doesn't really say anything that's funny. And so it just kind of falls apart in those moments.
And so I look at this and I'm thinking, through the development process, like at one point do they actually say, well, how is this true to the spirit of the website? And it just seems like no one's really asked that question. Instead, you just got this thing where they are making one of these sort of Wikipedia podcasts as a TV program, and it's completely effective as that. I'll be perfectly happy sitting down watching this again. But at the same time, like, I don't really understand what's going on, because there's just these discrepancies of why are the guys dressed like this? What is the joke against talking about Hillsong, about talking about the Cronulla riots? Like, it just kind of feels a bit too jarring. And it's just kind of fascinating to watch a TV series, which is, again, perfectly fine, but it just doesn't quite sort of meet the brief as to what it's supposed to be.
Troubling. It's always dangerous when that sort of well-known brand. National Lampoon went through with that when they started attaching their name to films, and the films stunk and they were well off the radar in terms of what Lampoon was known for. It unraveled what National Lampoon did. So hope that doesn't happen to the boys from Batuta. So the Batuta Advocate presents on Paramount Plus, the great Unwatched Network, apparently. I got along to the movies and saw... I saw You Hurt My Feelings.
What kind of story were you thinking about, Hal?
Something in a prison.
Oh, all right. And what about a prison interests you?
Jail.
For sure.
Happy anniversary.
We're so lucky.
Yeah.
So, Elliot tells me you're a writer.
And your last one, it should have done better.
There's lots of new voices. Refugees, cancer, murder, abuse.
I'm an old voice.
You're the best voice.
Maybe if Dad hadn't just been verbally abusive, it would have been a bestseller.
Everywhere. It's in limited release. This one stars Julia Louis-Dreyfus and what's his name? I've forgotten. I'd start this again. What is his name? God, I've forgotten his name.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember who it was, because I actually know who you're
talking about. Tobias Menzies.
That's right, yeah. And
Tobias
I like
Menzies. Okay. In limited release everywhere through Sony Pictures is the new Nicole Holofcener film. I think that's how you say it. You Hurt My Feelings. It stars Julia Louis-Dreyfus and Tobias Menzies as a New York married couple. He's a marriage therapist. She's a author. She's just published some memoirs, which did okay, didn't do great, got some good reviews, and she's just finished her first fiction work, which she's having a terrible crisis of creativity over. He keeps reassuring her that it's great, it's a good book, you're going to be fine. But it is soon found out in a moment of when they're apart and she happens to hear him talking in a shop that he doesn't really like the book. Now, this totally unravels her artist's ego and her very fragile state of mind and starts to really impact the marriage. At the same time, he's had a series of clients at his marriage therapist office which start to really attack him and his worth in the professional realm, notably Amber Tamblyn and David Cross, as a married couple who've been going to him for 13 years and now want their money back.
Real life couple.
This is a real life couple. Yeah, exactly. It's a very sweet, funny, and I guess some detractors may call it a New York story, and there's certain elements that play into that kind of New York vibe about it, but it's also a very universal comedy about the little lies you tell to those that you love, you know, out of the goodness of your heart and trying to be encouraging, but which can sort of ultimately unravel the intimacy and the honesty that you share with each other. The way it's dealt with on screen is so... It borderline sitcom-y in parts, and a lot of Nicole Holofcener's films have been that, but the best of them, and this is one of the best of them, she's able to find a real honesty and truthfulness in the way these characters interact. And Julia Louis-Dreyfus is both very effective as the partner of Tobias Menzies. They've got a great chemistry together and a really terrific sort of fragile on-screen persona as well. There's none of the brashness or the confidence of Elaine in this character. You can't imagine this is Elaine 20 years down the track after the Seinfeld days. This is a very different character that she's playing here, and one that she handles really, really beautifully on screen. Michaela Watkins is her sister, who's having her own troubles with a partner who's not a very good part-time actor. is also terrific, has some very funny moments. So this is just one of those really gentle growing up films, which has a lot of warm moments and small laughs, and ultimately just proves really, really satisfying. So for the 30 pluses out there, I'm just over 30, so I really enjoyed it. And I think I can honestly recommend it to those of a similar age. So get out and see it. You Hurt My Feelings from Sony Pictures is in limited release.
So Tobias Menzies, Simon should be more across Tobias Menzies than he is. He played for Prince Philip.
I remember him. He was the divorced dad who Aisling Bea almost gets with, or does get with, in her series as well, which whose name I've forgotten as well. Gee, I've really got my thinking hat on today. But I do know of his face.
And look.
Was he in Outlander? I think he was.
Yeah, he's in Outlander as well. Supporting cast in this as well. You got Michaela Watkins from The Trophy Wife in this. You got Sarah Steele from The Good Wife in this. You got Zach Cherry from all sorts of things. Zach Cherry.
He's a real dick in this movie. Zach Cherry's a real dick in this movie. And I think he's meant to be in these early scenes. He sort of comes around to a bit of warmth in the end, but he's kind of this jerk who provided a lot of big laughs, but really hated him in the first 10 minutes of the film.
Yeah, like people know him from Severance and he's in that Netflix show You. I think he's in that first season. People know him by face.
Why should I love Michaela Watkins? Because she's wonderful in this. Where does she come from? She plays the younger sister in this.
Look, Simon, if you want to be just bowled over by a show that is just sneaky, really, really good, there's a show called Casual, which I'm pretty sure is streaming on Netflix these days. It was originally like a Hulu original back in the day. It's a little bit sort of feels a bit samey, the first episode or two. The premise of it is that there's a recently divorced woman and her teenage daughter, and they've moved in recently with her brother. And so the brother is like a tech guy who created a dating app, which is apparently quite good and has made him like a large amount of money.
And Michael is trying to get front and center of that.
And what's that, sorry?
And Michaela's front and center of that, is she?
So, yeah, she's the female lead in it. And so it's about this sort of brother trying to get his sister to re-enter the world of dating. And that's the thing that kicks off the series. But very quickly, the show starts to become a bit more textually interesting with the characters than what that sounds.
She's wonderful opposite Julia Louis in this. So it's, I'll be chasing her out. So,
she's great. So check her out in Casual. And also there's this show Trophy Wife, which is better than the name of the show suggests, and better than the pilot episode that show suggests. But you can find that one on Disney Plus.
Yeah. Okay. All right. This brings us to the intermission. Dan and Simon pitch, pitch four Oz set franchise extensions that will bring work to our local talent pool, always thinking of the industry we are here. So basically we're going to come up with two each, other franchises that might work down under. Now this is different to the Modern Family Come to Australia episodes or the Banachek Down Under type episodes.
Are you being served down under?
Are you being served? They were classics. They were great. So these are different to that. We're actually sort of pitching a full series transformed to Sydney, like they've done with NCIS Sydney. Why don't you kick us off, Dan Barrett? This was your idea.
Okay, so each of us is going to present two ideas, and should I do both back-to-back? I'll do both back-to-back. Okay.
So, sure, look, why not?
Yeah. My first one, and this is because I've just been watching like a fair bit of this as a franchise recently, and it was just front of center. Why is there not Star Trek Down Under? Okay, so Star Trek takes place while they're traveling through space, and you obviously don't want to set it on Earth because it's just a whole bunch of people walking around in funny costumes. So my idea is that you got an Australian-based starship. So I always think if you're going to have like an American, like if you're going to have like a, and they're doing with NCIS, basically you want to take like an American and bring it into like a fish out of water situation with an all Australian cast. So
yeah.
I always like it when it's not just if it's a franchise extension, you don't just want to have like just random American who turns up hanging out with Australians in the Starfleet ship. You want to have like a classic Star Trek character. So I reckon you get the character of Worf, who's like the Klingon from Star Trek Next Generation. iconic character, put him on a starship that's staffed entirely by Australians, and the dynamic you've got there is that him as a very militaristic Klingon type character, and he's become accustomed to the ways of humanity as depicted through American Starfleet characters, okay, put him on the Starfleet Australian ship, which, I don't know, what are we going to call it? The USS Endeavor, we'll call it that.
Okay, right, yeah, put him on there. That'll go down well.
And the hilarity and the tension within the show is the fact that he can't deal with the fact that everyone on the ship is just really laid back, okay? So on Star Trek, on like, you know, the Next Generation, on the Enterprise, Captain Picard will say something like, make it so, and then, you know, they'll zoom off into the distance. So on this one, like, I just kind of like the idea that everyone's just like, yeah, she'll be right. And so he has to deal with that as a Klingon.
It's going to end up looking like those online gambling ads that Shaquille O'Neal is doing with at the moment. Yeah. That's exactly what it is. So with those as a back point, I can sort of see that working. Of course, I'm lying. It's not going to work at all. But I do get what you're saying. What's your next one?
Okay, so my next one is, I had a conversation during the week with a friend via text who just randomly said, is The Walking Dead the show that's got the largest number of spin-offs? And I said, no, well, surely Star Trek is probably the one with the largest number of spin-offs. But I think The Walking Dead may actually have Star Trek pipped, because Star Trek is a spin-off from the brand Star Trek, but not necessarily from the original show, whereas all The Walking Dead spin-offs are kind of from that original show. So with that in mind, I just thought, well, why not like an Australian Walking Dead? But
I can see this.
Here's the twist on this. This is the gimmick, which is that The Walking Dead, like, it's in Atlanta. They don't really name it Atlanta, but, you know, it's in Atlanta. And so, you know, fairly high popular sort of an area. The joke on this one is that the zombie, it's just like one zombie who's in the middle of the outback, and Australia is a really big place with very few people around. And it's about this zombie that's been just like walking through the desert for, you know, months, that is just kind of falling apart because he hasn't been able to, you know, eat any brains. And so you just come across some true blue Australian types that are like, Struth, look, it's a zombie. And then it's just them playing with a zombie. Like, they're not going to let him bite him or anything, but like, there's just one zombie they're going to contend with.
All right. First of all, it's already been done in a movie called Wormwood, which came out a few years ago, and its sequel.
Sorry, was this an Australian movie?
Yeah, absolutely it was. Well, yeah.
Wormwood. Saw it.
And everyone saw it. It was a huge
I don't think everyone saw it, but it did do it. I do know what he's talking about.
Yeah. A zombie walking through the outback. It'd kind of be hard. What is he just going to bump into people camping?
Like, wasn't Wormwood actually like a proper horror film?
Proper horror zombie film, yeah.
Yeah, this isn't a horror film by any means. It's just people going, Struth, it's a zombie.
That right.
And then just getting about their stuff.
Like, you know, I'm glad you put a lot of thought into this. Great. Star Trek and zombies. No, jeez. All right. This is going to be my two. I actually did put a little bit of thinking into this. This is my pitch. Many years ago, there was a makeover series called...
Before you tell me about like how you put a lot of thought into this, is this going to be one of these things where suddenly you start pitching a reality show in Scandinavia that's got nothing at all to do with the question which you posed?
Reality show in Sydney, Australia.
Are they selling property?
Here we go. Hang on a second. Listen, Pimp My Ride. I'm going to reboot Pimp My Ride. This is the pitch letter. You ready? Confirmed Rev Head Eric Banner hosts a working class makeover show with a difference. The beloved vehicles of down on their luck Aussie battlers are given a facelift and then sold to collectors, with all the funds returned to the car owners. Celebrities like racing car drivers, commentators, actors, etc. are called on to contribute to the restoration, adding to the resale value. So it's a feel-good show, but it gets the whole sort of working class car, you know, rebuild culture happening. And you got Eric Banner out front there bringing in all his mates. You can have like Kate Blanchett doing some sanding and you know, Gary Sweet putting some upholstery on the chairs and that sort of stuff. So I think this has a real feel-good factor about it and will take the world of Australian reality TV by storm. Did we ever have a local version of Pimp My Ride?
I don't know, but I feel good about the idea of not watching this. What's your next one?
Okay. Second one. This one's a little bit left field.
Oh, wait, sorry. Did you know you can watch Pimp My Ride right now streaming on Paramount Plus?
Yes, you do. Well, nobody watches Paramount Plus. Bob the Builder was an iconic character. The kids love him. Now, this one is a live-action reworking of the classic cartoon character in the spirit of Touch by an Angel or Highway to Heaven. A hired handyman helps solve the worries of people from all walks of Australian life, traveling across the country to find a new friend in need every week. This thing has everything you need, a feel-good premise, and lots of plumber butt crack. Sorry, nothing is more Australian.
Is this an Australian version of Bob the Builder or of Highway to Heaven?
It incorporates the Bob the Builder character into a premise that's similar to Touch by an Angel or Highway to Heaven, that sort of thing. I think these are good pitches. These would work.
I mean, that's maybe certainly not the pitches. Bob the Builder
one. Yeah. I think the Pimp My Ride one might work. Anyway, So that's this week's intermission. Bring your show down under. We'll help you get it made, said no one ever. No, said the federal government. They give bloody giant Hollywood productions all sorts of tax breaks to get them down here. Oh, which reminds me.
And none of those productions even have any characters saying Struth.
Struth, mate, Struth. There is a show. I meant to ask you about this prior to the show during our production meeting. A show called Stars on Mars, which was shot in Coober-Pedy in the South Australian outback and helped to be made by the South Australian Film Corporation, has just begun on US television. It's with a series of quote-unquote celebrities, people like Lance Armstrong and who else is in there? Ronda Rousey and Ariel Winter from Modern Family. They all...
Excuse me, Simon. You've missed two of the biggest names in there. One would be Mr. William Shatner from...
Well, he hosts the show, yes. He's in Mission Control. Also, he's in Mission Control. He's not actually on the red planet itself, which is the Australian outback. But is this coming to Australian television? It's on Hulu. Well, it's on Reality Fox.
You haven't mentioned like the key name in it, which is McLovin from the movie Superbad.
Yes, Chris Mintz-Plasse is in there as well. So this sounds like a lot of fun. They've all got to dress up like astronauts and pretend that the Australian outback is Mars, and they've got to live in the red dirt as well as in the space age.
Question?
Is it in Australia yet?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either. It started on one of the Fox reality shows and then went to Hulu, but I don't think it's come to Australia yet. So I know what I'll be spending all weekend watching.
Yeah, sure.
Stars on Mars. I want to see what Lance Armstrong's up to now.
Yeah, William Shatner was talking about making the show when he appeared on the WCF podcast 2 weeks ago, which was a surprisingly good interview.
Yeah, okay. I'll check it out. Dan Barrett, what else have you been watching?
What else have I been watching? I'm going to run through this super quickly. I started watching the new season 2 of Star Trek, Strange New Worlds. It's pretty good. There's lots of pew, 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 and then, they beam off.
Serious critical comment there from Dan Barrett.
Yeah. If you like the first season, you'll love the second one. It's more of the same, which is pretty good. It's a pretty good series. I've started rewatching the Indiana Jones movies in preparation for the, new one coming out. The thing I realized while I started watching these Indiana Jones films is that I've seen these movies just so, so many times. And I think I may have watched them too many times.
Oh, really? They're starting to lose their allure?
It's just wallpaper now at this point.
Like the first one is one of the seminal movies of my life. I can watch it I'll watch it a couple of times every year and still get the huge rush out of it. I've come to appreciate the second one more over the years.
No,
it's all right. Horribly racist, but it's still really enjoyable. 3 and 4, yep, they are what they are.
I like 3 quite a bit. I like that way more than the second one, but either way, whatever. And then the last thing I wanted to mention is there's this show on Apple TV Plus. It's a kids show. It's called Stillwater. And all these people, and I mentioned in my newsletter the other day, so if people, read it, they'd be well across this. So I apologize for recycling old gear. But the thing with Stillwater is that at the moment, you've got a whole bunch of adults watching Bluey. And the reason they're watching Bluey is because, one, it's a pretty funny program and, it's whatnot. But Bluey's very much about that idea of encouraging play. What Stillwater is, it's nowhere near as loud and rambunctious as Bluey is. This is a very quiet TV program about a very large panda bear that lives with 3 human children, or at least next door to the children. I'm not sure. They live like around each other. But this panda bear, Stillwater, he's there to try to teach kids about regulating their emotions and understanding why they feel the way that they do. So every episode has it's 2 episodes, 2 stories per episode. but it has like one of the kids who has some sort of emotional problem. And then it's basically them talking through their feelings and still want to ask them questions. So it kind of seems like animated character therapy while you're watching it. But there's something that's just like really lovely and very pleasant about this program. Anyway, it's called Stillwater. It's on Apple TV Plus. If you're an adult, you're probably not going to watch more than like one or two of these, but it is strangely really watchable. Like, Simon, give it a look. But first of all, watch Casual, and you know, I think that's more worth your time.
But yeah, it's on my list. I have very quickly this week, I have been watching a Netflix series called The Days. This is Netflix's version in an 8-episode form of the Fukushima nuclear disaster. It's a very big budget Japanese series made with the Netflix team. And I'm 3 episodes into this. The actual reenactment and the special effects that show the tidal wave hitting the nuclear site and the surrounding village is really potent stuff. It's really sort of hard to watch because they do it right, and they get the water effects, which are notoriously hard to make look real. They get it very right, and the panic in the people's eyes and the panic in the officials' eyes back in the sort of the bunker where they're trying to control everything is palpable. Second time this podcast we've used that word. It's called The Days, and if you enjoyed, and enjoyed's probably not the right word, but if you watched and recall with fondness Chernobyl, this is probably another take on the horrors of nuclear power gone wrong. The Days on Netflix.
Yeah.
Dan Barrett.
Something
this is one of the most popular segments of the show. It's called In History. June 17, 2018, which film sets a box office record for an animated release, earning US $180 million in its opening weekend? June 17, 2018.
Now, I actually know this, and the only reason I can say this with such confidence is only because you mentioned the film like last week or the week before on the podcast, and it got me looking it up because I couldn't actually remember anything about the film, and then realized I never saw the sequel. But that film is called The Incredibles 2.
Well done. It is, sir. June 18, 2005, Who debuts as the 10th Doctor Who in the episode The Parting of the Ways?
I believe that would be one Christopher Eccleston.
Oh, gotcha. David Tennant, my friend, 2005.
Really?
Let me just check. Yeah, David Tennant is what I got here.
2005, like the first Doctor Who of the new revamp.
Christopher Eccleston was well before that.
No, he was the first Doctor Who. Christopher
Eccleston. I think so. David Tennant.
No, David Tennant came like after Eccleston, and the revamp was in 2005.
Wow. I'm going to have to check on that. We may have a discrepancy in the answers. I'll get the judges on that. It's definitely David Tennant because I've literally just copied and pasted it from the history website that I use. So maybe they were wrong. I will double check that. That does seem a long time ago for David Tennant, doesn't it?
Here's the problem with your question here, which is that technically the answer to your question is right. Who debuts the 10th Doctor Who in the episode The Parting of Ways? And I don't know whether he's the 10th, but you know, he's certainly in that episode. It is David Tennant, but you do start it with June 18th, 2005, and in 2005, that was the season of Christopher Eccleston.
Wow. Well, that's just a straight cut and paste from the website. I will be writing them a very stern letter. Thanks for pointing that out, Mr. Barrett. Okay, that's interesting to know. See if I got this one wrong. June 20, 1980, The Blues Brothers debuts in how many US theaters? Now, remember, this is at the height of the American summer. Nowadays, movies debut 3,500 cinemas. How many cinemas did The Blues Brothers debut in on June 20, 1980?
I feel this is going to be some sort of a trick question, like it's one cinema.
594. It was a wide release. It was one of their biggest releases
Was that a lot for the time?
Yeah, that was a big one for the time. Yeah, it really was. And on the same day, 8 days later, June 20, 1988, what happened to the Price is Right model Janice Pennington on this day? June 20, 1988, the Price is Right model Janice Pennington.
I have no idea, but I'm just going to say like was proposed to.
Well, this is a terrible story, actually. A studio camera swung around very quickly, knocking her unconscious into the audience. She was off work for nearly 3 months with severe head injuries, and when her comeback. Now, I did go onto YouTube and try to find the footage of that, but it's not available. But the episode where she comes back and Bob Barker gives her a big hug and she gets a standing ovation from the audience is on YouTube. Beautiful woman, didn't do any long-term damage to the moneymaker. But yes, apparently she was struck by a camera during a taping of The Price is Right and knocked unconscious.
Okay, and I'd just like to backtrack a little bit. Your question was, who debuted as the 10th Doctor? And that is officially David Tennant, but you've screwed it up
David
because you said 2005.
Okay, so the question and the parting of the ways is the episode that Tennant was in, but the 2005 is wrong.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. I'll be writing a very stern letter to onthisday.com. All right, birthday time.
No, not happy birthday. No, not that. Please, no. Not happy birthday.
Sorry, I didn't realize it was so well resourced.
I've been using the same website for 3 years. I'm starting to run out of questions. All right. It's birthday time. We'll find a way to put a sting in there somehow. All right. June 19, 1967, the beautiful Mia Sara. June 20, 1931, James Tolkien. June 22, 1949, Meryl Streep. And June 23, 1947, one Brian Brown. Now, these four actors have all shared a certain co-star. Can you name the films and the co-star?
Well, I don't know about the co-star, but I believe that all four of these actors at one stage appeared in the 1990s syndicated drama, The Hat Squad.
What? Are you being serious? I don't even know when you're being serious with these hits.
The Hat Squad?
No, I don't
know. The Hat Squad was a TV series from the early 90s that had James Tolkien in it. And it was about four brothers whose father was killed. I think he might have been a cop. I can't quite remember. But they end up fighting crime as part of an elite police unit together called the Hat Squad, and they all get around in
wearing
fancy,
hats.
Like fedora
wearing
hats. Yeah.
Nice one. For those of you who don't know James Tolkien, he's the bald headmaster from Back to the Future who does a lot of screaming and yelling.
Yeah, but also
and you can always see our birthday.
But you also know him from the Hat Squad, a show that was cancelled after like nine episodes.
Okay, this is where you drop in vision of the Hat Squad so we know what we're talking about. Okay, so these four actors, Meryl Streep, James Tolkien, Mia Sara, and Brian Brown.
Okay, so wait, hang on.
Okay, he's getting cocky, he thinks he knows.
No, like, I don't know, I'm trying to think of like Mia Sara roles. Like, I feel that she's probably the easiest one because I feel that her filmography is probably the lightest of the four. Because James Tolkien, like, I haven't looked at his filmography, but like, I've seen him in so many things over the years that I just assume that he's one of these just consistently working actors who you look at it and say, that's not a long filmography. That's a Michael Ironside level filmography.
Okay, sure. So yeah, that's very
true. I presume he's
been
a character
actor.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, Mia Sara, like, obviously, she's been Ferris Bueller, probably her best known role. So you've got there like an Alan Ruck, you've got there like a Matthew Broderick, but I can't think of a Brian Brown Ruck or Broderick appearance, so kind of rule that out. She's opposite Tom Cruise in what's that called, Legend?
Is that the name Legend, of the film? Yeah.
I haven't seen that, but I can't think of Cruise appearing opposite Meryl Streep or Tolkien or Brian Brown. I got nothing.
Well, you were within a hair's breadth of getting the answer. The answer is Tom Cruise. Mia Sara was in Legend.
Okay.
James Tolkien was famously in Top Gun. He uttered the famous words, "You're writing the checks, your ego's writing checks your body can't cash." So he was in Top Gun. Brian Brown, of course, in Cocktail. And Meryl Streep starred opposite Tom Cruise in the Robert Redford director.
How could I forget Cocktail?
And Meryl Streep was in the Robert Redford directed film Lines for Lambs, opposite one Tom Cruise.
Yes.
So there you go. Okay. You were so close, Dan Barrett,
I couldn't connect the Meryl Streep to Tom Cruise. Like, to me, that seemed like the obvious thing that I could think of a film the two of them been in together.
Well done. I'm glad you got Legend. That's one out of the bag. That's one of my favorite films. I didn't know if you'd pick up
on that.
I've
never seen it.
Very disappointed you didn't get Top Gun. So.
Yeah, Legend's just on the list of films I've always wanted to check out because I love Mia Sara and Tom Cruise. You know, why not?
Never seen.
No.
Wow. Okay, get on it. Tim Curry as the demon, one of the great demonic performances.
You've never seen the sitcom The Trophy Wife, so whatever.
I've never seen The Hat Squad, so I've got a lot of catching up to do.
Oh my God, you must be so embarrassed right now.
Yes, I'll never get over this. All right, sign off. I want to go to bed.
Okay, yeah, me too. It's been such a long day, Simon. Folks, this has been Screen Watching. My name's Dan Barrett. You can find my newsletter, Always Be Watching. That's at alwaysbewatching.com. And on that one, you can find the latest information on streaming, movies, and it's too late. I don't care. Just go to alwaysbewatching.com. You'll love it. Just sign up to the newsletter. It'll turn
I'm at Simon R. Foster 1 on the Twitter. You can read my words at screen-space.net. Everything about Screen Watching can be found at Screen Watching Podcast on Facebook, at @screen_watching on Twitter, at the Screen Watching YouTube channel. I missed an interview this week because I slept through the alarm. I felt very embarrassed. It's very unprofessional. No one big, just some guy. But I wish I hadn't done that. And email us at... It was Tom Cruise talking about Lines for Lambs. And email us at screenwatchingpodcast@gmail.com. We have a contest up on our Facebook page at the moment if tickets we're giving away to the new Ben Kingsley film, Dali Land. So give us a hoi hoi at screenwatchingpodcast@gmail.com.
Please tell me that's a theme park that's, you know, orientated around Dali.
Dali Land. Roller coasters in the shape of his mustache and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be good. Yeah. All right, my friend, good podcast. Okay. Looking forward to it. Next week, big week next week. Don't know why.
Lots Is it of because things to talk you're about. Not available to record the podcast and we've got to figure out something about that?
No, I'm here next week, but I will be away the week after that, so we're going to have to sort something out there. I'm very excited. Within a couple of days of recording this, I'll be watching Dial of Destiny, the new Indiana Jones films. I'm not watching any of the other films because I've seen them all. Yeah, so I've got lots going on. A weekend of movie watching at the Sydney Film Festival, which has been pretty good. I did 5 movies on Monday. That was madness. Why would I do that?
5? That's 6 too many. I don't know. It's late. Simon, yeah, let's get out of here. Yeah. Folks, we'll catch you next week.